Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon recording from downtown Nicosia in an incredibly hot heat wave. I think it's going to reach 45 or 46 today. And with me from Copenhagen, I have Sarah Arndt Linde. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And good to see you and to hear you again.
One of Sarah's peculiarities is that she's one of the few people I've actually interviewed twice. I first interviewed Sarah, it must have been about 2015 or 16. Yeah. She was still living in Israel. She had just started her journey, political is personal. And now she's reaching not the end of the journey, but a destination she always wanted to reach in terms of political is personal. So Sarah, the floor is yours. Introduce yourself and let's start the storytelling.
Thank you. First of all, my name is Sarah. Now I live in Copenhagen, which I'm very happy about. I'm Danish as well, so I have some roots here and my parents live here. It's not foreign, but it's not a place I've lived in my whole adulthood. I've lived in Israel for 17 years, which is a very long time. And
it is a long time. You've lived in New York?
Yeah, I lived in New York for a year. And then I'm the daughter of a diplomat, a Danish diplomat. So I had the typical moving around. And as a child, we moved around between Denmark and Geneva and Switzerland, France and Belgium. I'd never lived in Israel. I'm Jewish. I have an Israeli father. So I had been to Israel on visits many times to see my grandmother and other members of my father's family, but it wasn't something I'd intended to do, my move to Israel. I actually didn't know, now everyone's talking about Zionism. I didn't know what Zionism was until I came to Israel. I was maybe a little bit naive, and I didn't think I would end up living in Israel for that many years. From the very beginning, I wasn't sure if Israel was my place. I had like a love-hate relationship to Israel for the obvious reasons, but also for many reasons people from abroad don't know, are not so familiar with. And then when I started thinking about having my own family, I didn't feel personally that it would be responsible to continue living there. And
It's a very volatile area.
Yes.
It always has been.
Yeah.
And you never know when things are going to... Volatile and fluid. You never know when things are going to change.
Yeah. And it's also...
And whether it's for the good or the bad.
Yeah, it's very... unpredictable, very pragmatic. You have leaders that are very, you know, change their minds all the time, I feel. But another very important factor that people from abroad maybe don't know so much about Israel and also Palestine is that it's very expensive to live there. So having a family there was not an option. I wouldn't be able to afford with my husband to live there. It's more expensive. I think it's now on like the number one place in the world in terms of expenses. And I'm talking everything, basic foods.
Rent.
Yeah.
And where were you living? Were you living in Tel Aviv?
I was living in that area, in the Tel Aviv area. And I've always been... someone from a very, very young age, someone who looked for, I'm not a hero, I don't want to portray myself but I didn't like injustices and was very drawn to injustice where I lived, if I saw it, have probably also always been a leftist in my in terms of my ideology. And then I knew nothing about Israel, really. I knew very little about Israel and the Palestinians. I knew before I moved there that there was a conflict, but that was more or less it. I thought, I have the Holocaust in my family, and that is something that actually has formed a very big part of maybe my spiritual attachment to Israel. And it also made me believe, which sounds very naive and a little bit weird to say, but I felt that as Jews and as Israelis, we were not capable of doing other people wrong because of all the suffering we had been through as a people. And this is very black and white thinking. But when I moved to Israel, I then was exposed to different things. I already, within a year of having lived in Israel, I visited the West Bank for the first time. And I wasn't exposed to something super traumatic, but I saw some things already going through checkpoints.
I think those checkpoints, unless you've been to Israel, I think those checkpoints are horrific. So unless you've lived that process of actually seeing people going through those iron gates and waiting and pushing and the hours to wait and the being turned away, I don't think, because I also have checkpoints.
Oh, right.
But my checkpoint is, you show an ID document and you go. Mm-hmm. That's very civilized.
Do you have soldiers there with guns? Or is it less?
Well, it's police.
Okay.
You have police in the Greek Cypriot and the Turkish Cypriot checkpoint, but it's a checkpoint and you go through a buffer zone. But it's still, it's still very civilized. You show a ID document, you have a conversation, I pass through regularly, so it's a good morning, how are you today kind of thing, and you go through. And the same on the other side, the Turkish Cypriot side, it's the same. You say good morning, he looks at it, pass through computer, and you leave. It's very rare that there's an issue, unless you're on the issue goes if you're not an EU citizen, and you haven't entered Cyprus. If you're coming from here, the south to the north, unless you've come through Larnaca Airport, they might not let you through because you're a third country person, so you're not allowed to cross the checkpoint.
Okay.
But it's civilized. It's not the horrific lines that you see in the checkpoints in Israel.
Yeah, it's very different. I was privileged when I went through... when I've gone through checkpoints, because I'm not a Palestinian living there. But I do remember the first time I went through a checkpoint in Hebron, which is a very intense place to visit, where you have checkpoints inside.
Hebron is
on the West Bank.
And Hebron is West Bank, yes.
You have checkpoints within the city itself. And I remember going through this checkpoint where you had Israeli soldiers, which you have at checkpoints there. But there was one soldier who was literally with his, I think, M16 aiming at you in case someone were to make a wrong move, or and also on me. And that felt very,
It must be scary.
Yeah. There you kind of feel right away that someone can decide if you are to live or to die.
Unilaterally, it's a split second decision one person makes over your life.
Yeah. And that's just a couple of hours in Hebron, and as someone who is can go back, I don't have to visit the West Bank. I could have not visited the place at all, but I was curious. I wanted to see for myself. And what can I say? So, yeah.
And what led you in all this process? You'd been there a year. What led you to start the political and personal project?
Well, from the very beginning, because I'm such a naive peacenik.
join the club.
To use what people have called me and get my power back.
I'm the same. I naively believe that there's a possibility of peace in this world, and I just carry on regardless.
I think it's...
I think we need to be.
Yeah.
No, but I think we need to be. We cannot speak to the voices of doom all the time.
No.
We've got to keep...
I think also, especially when you live abroad and you're not affected directly, at least, by what is going on in Israel and Palestine, I feel sometimes that the people who from abroad are cynical don't understand that the people who live there have no choice than to have hope or to, especially if you have a child, that's what I think about. You know, if I was, let's say, in Gaza and I had my daughter there, I couldn't tell her, well, there's no hope.
It's all over.
Let's give up. I'd have to give her hope or to fight. Even if... It's not fair. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Because it's something that I had a discussion with some friends. If you were a mother living in Gaza, would one of your decisions be to leave?
Yeah. Most definitely, yeah.
I've got a lot of Palestinian friends, and this attachment to the land is quite strong. So where do you detach from the land, and if you leave, where do you go to?
I think I understand the from what I've heard from the women in Gaza that I've interviewed, but that I'm also just in touch with. There is a very strong sense of home, also because home is home for everyone. Also in Europe, you know, it's when people say, you know, why can't the Palestinians just go there? Or the same about Israelis. Why can't they just go back to Europe? Or your home is your home. Would you want to just move to even to the town next to you? Would you do that freely? Mm. Not everyone would do that. So there is a sense of home. And in Gaza, there is also the many other challenges that many people abroad don't have, which is when you leave Gaza to go and live somewhere else, you can't just come for visits every couple of months. It's very difficult not only to get into Gaza, but especially to get out. So a lot of the people who've left, they kind of feel like, okay, I don't know.
They're never going to see Gaza again.
Yeah, if they have grandparents. I know one specifically who told me that she knew it would be the last time she would see her grandparents, which is an awful thing.
An awful feeling in the heart that it's never again. Yeah. So let's get back to your political is personal. And to explain to the listeners, political is personal is a collection of narratives with different kinds of women living in the Israel-Palestine area. So it's Israelis, Jews, Palestinian Arabs, and it's it's a diverse collection of women living in the area. What started off your need to put this together, even though I know you're by nature a storyteller like me, or a story collector more than that?
I like that, story collector. Yeah. So I studied also conflict resolution and Middle Eastern history, and was from the beginning of my stay in Israel involved in different ways with peace activism, which you have a lot of, by the way, in Israel and Palestine, still now. And at the same time, I became drawn to everything that had to do with women, feminism, and gender. I became, separately, also very aware of what it is to be a woman and all the injustices there, which you also have in Denmark. Denmark is not a perfect gender equality country.
But in the Israel-Palestine area, they multiplied.
Yeah, there's a lot. Sometimes I say that Israel is the land of injustices in so many ways. Mm. And also in Palestine, obviously. I began writing a blog. I felt the need to scribble down some things about my experiences of living in Israel. I wrote about the conflict for my eyes and some other themes. And I figured I like this. I like writing. I'm curious about people.
I think that's what creates a story collector. It means you have an innate curiosity to discover another human being.
Yeah.
You actually want to, you don't want to hear I'm okay. You actually want to hear their story.
Yeah.
You want the three dimension of their story, not the what we show the world.
Yeah, image. I feel that, so I've obviously studied all these things academically, but sometimes I feel that I've learned a lot more about this conflict from hearing these women's stories. It's like each story is a world in itself and has a lot of nuances. And yeah, I wanted to, and it had to be about women, because as everywhere in the world, women are just not heard as much, especially not in matters of war and peace. You've had no women in the ceasefire negotiations recently. There are changes going on at the moment. Women that are working with the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 in Israel and Palestine are really pushing to be there and present and be heard, but you still don't have enough at all women in politics in Israel and Palestine. There's always a sense of, no, it's us, the older men, that know we have the experience and we do things behind closed doors, you know, smoking our cigars. Yes.
No transparency and transactional negotiations.
Yeah. And it's not a woman's not real peace. Place. You can go and do your cute peace work. and maybe we'll need you when we do a photo shoot or when we need a gender perspective or woman's perspective. So I just wanted to contribute to the work that is already being done in representing women by just simply interviewing women and conveying their voices and putting them out there. So
I have had the honor of also, I mean, I've been involved in this conflict since my student days, and I'm an old woman, so it's since the 80s I wrote my dissertation on the area. And to me, there are so many incredibly smart, creative, strong women throughout the area that are battling to get to the front lines in terms of negotiations, and they're not listening. These stupid men think that aren't getting the message. If you keep on doing the same thing, if you keep on getting bad results and you keep on doing things in the same way, why are you not getting the message that maybe you need to change the way you do things? And one of the ways is actually introducing diverse perspectives, which includes women.
Well, it would mean maybe that they would have to give up a little bit of their seats. And that's probably not a nice feeling for them, or I'm imagining. But yeah, it's not only a matter, you know, a lot of times when people talk about this women, peace, security, there's this thing about that women need to take over and rule the world. But for me, it's just a matter of we are 50% of this world and we're not being represented, enough at all, which we're being treated as a minority. And it doesn't make sense to me. Like this conflict affects women sometimes even more than men, but we also need to be part of the discussion. And it's not only women, it's also women from all sorts of backgrounds and other representations of a society. You can't only have 2% you really need to.
But I think that's why when talking about women, peace and security, and I like to include the word gender instead of woman or in addition to woman, it's opening up the space to, you need diverse voices in a peace process.
Yeah.
Because a population is diverse. It's not black and white, or women and men, or rich and poor. It's diverse, and within each woman, there are different kinds of women, and religions, there are different kinds of religions, and different economic standards. So to me, there needs, in order for peace to work, you need to open up the space for people to be able to speak if they want to. So to me, it's a case of opening, being diverse, opening up the space for, if you really want peace, you want everyone to contribute, because then everyone will be invested in maintaining the peace.
Yeah, and that is exactly why civil society, it might sound like a slogan for a lot of people. Oh, yes, civil society, these cute peaceniks that are out demonstrating or talking about peace, but they are literally, and I don't know so much about other conflicts, but I know in Israel and Palestine, they are literally on the ground. They are in touch with people that are very much affected by the conflict. They've gained so much knowledge. They have so many skills, and they not only need to be part of the conversation, they need to lead it.
Because they're usually the first responders.
Yeah.
They're usually there as soon as the conflict explodes or starts. It's usually the woman that if someone's hurt, they will deal with healing the trauma or fixing the trauma. If they need to move, they will be moving the family and looking for a place to live or food or water. So they literally know exactly what's happening, which is why aren't you including them? I mean, they know this is the pulse. It's not just being cute about fixing refugee camps and whatever. It's about what do you do when that bomb hits?
Yeah.
Who's affected and what needs to be done to fix it or whatever.
Yeah.
So is this, so how did you start picking the women you interviewed?
It doesn't sound too professional maybe, but the first woman that I interviewed was a friend of mine that I worked with at the time. At the time I worked in a very...
I think it's very professional because you started off with someone you're comfortable with. So you started off, you were dirty, you were smoothing yourself into the process.
Yeah, I wanted to see, okay, what does this feel like for me also? And I'm not a journalist. I didn't work within a particular format. I wasn't affiliated with anyone. I was just me. So I said, okay, it needs to be someone that I know. And here is a woman that is a friend of mine who's a Jewish Israeli. And then the second interview was also with someone I knew who was a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And then I just, from there, it was, oh, I know this woman. You should talk to her. And then it kind of...
word of mouth.
But I also a lot of times just contacted people that I didn't know on Facebook, especially in terms of the women in Gaza, because I've never been able to meet. Before that, I hadn't met physically a Palestinian woman from Gaza because it was close to impossible. So I reached out in that way. But the more women I interviewed and got to know, the more trust also there was, the more women I could reach, especially on the Palestinian side.
When you make contact with one person in that community and you make a good impression, which if you go in with authenticity, it is a good impression, then they will recommend you. And then if I know you've spoken to my friend Aisha or whatever, then I'll say, okay, since she's spoken, this person must be trustworthy. It's the only way to do it in these closed communities.
Yeah.
Or the communities that have no trust, because there is no trust in these communities.
Yeah. It's not to say that Israeli Jewish women haven't been, that sometimes there hasn't been some lack of trust. Like, what do you want to do with this? Where is it going? Mm. They can always be anonymous, which is, and they see the text before it's published. And if they don't want it to be published, then it won't be. But with Palestinian women, especially those in the West Bank or in Gaza, there is a fear of, are you affiliated with something in Israel that could punish me,
do me harm?
Yeah, and there's also fear of judgment from one's communities. Oh, she has been this woman has been interviewed by someone who lives in Israel. That's not so good, or
that's not always a good thing.
So there's also this fear of being judged by one's community of because of the fact that they've been interviewed by someone like me.
How many women did you end up interviewing?
I've interviewed a little over 100 women. I want to mention, though, that I would love to continue interviewing. I don't see it as final. I just, life came, you know, life took over, and I then also got pregnant. But I would love to go back to it at some point, see how I could continue. But we'll see. Right now, it's a little difficult to travel to Israel.
Yes. And tell me, and what did you do with the stories you got that you heard? It wasn't just anecdotal. You analyzed the stories, did you not?
I did it, but in a different setting. I didn't want to... The main purpose, or the main thing of Politico is Personal, was just to almost to transcribe what they were saying. Not the like what I'm saying now, I don't know, but more or less all the words they were saying, because I also found I found it very interesting hearing the small nuances and the contradictions they were saying, which I find to be so human and also very important elements. Like, some of the women have actually contradicted themselves in the interviews. And I guess if you were a journalist working for mainstream media, you would use that
as a tool.
No, you just wouldn't include, you would, like I've said before, you would flatten it out. So that it makes sense.
So you wouldn't include the dimension.
So that it makes sense, because, wait, hold on. She said this in the beginning, and then she said something else, and it doesn't make sense. It needs to be streamlined so that the readers can understand, and said there's, again, this black and white thing. But I've seen so many times the women sharing a lot of contradictory, or what for many would seem as contradictory feelings, like how you know, how you can feel both fear and you can feel anger and hate even towards the other side, but at the same time have a lot of empathy,
compassion.
And these are things that should not be flattened out. It's because it explains a lot of what is going on, that people in Israel and Palestine are not just robots. They are ordinary people who have feelings, who have been through a lot. And we like, maybe from abroad, to put them into boxes. Palestinians feel like this and this, and Israelis feel like this and this. But it's all very fluid and nuanced and complicated, the feelings you can have.
But Sarah, even if you look at individuals that haven't lived in an area as contentious as Israel Palestine, we are not one dimensional. So it's not just I hate Turks. I'm talking in my context, okay? It's not just I hate Turks. I mean, it's not as simple as that. Because there's the political, which is the big picture, and then there's the personal when you meet someone.
Yeah.
And you have good experiences and bad experiences, even at the personal sector. So I think I agree with you. It's very naive of them to think that everyone has one dimension.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to read and understand, because we are really, really very complicated as human beings, because in the same cup, you have anger and compassion.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because the emotions themselves are not simple. Being angry is not as simple as I want to beat you up. Being angry means you make me feel powerless.
Yeah.
Being angry means I would like you to leave. Or, I mean, it means a lot of things. So I think I like the fact that you describe that, because it's, we seem to get the impression that it's Palestinians or Israelis or all these Zionistic, one-dimensional human beings that just want to take over Gaza, and they have this hate and disregard, and the Palestinians are just a bunch of terrorists. Okay? Yeah.
Or I think also the other way around. I do see in a lot of the movements here and the debates that either Palestinians are terrorists or future terrorists in terms of children, yes, which is awful, or they are passive victims.
I have to tell you, I stopped talking to someone because just after October 7th, it was a very good friend of a friend of mine's, and we were having dinner, and this person turned around and said to me, "I don't care if your Palestinian children die, because ultimately they're going to be terrorists." And I thought, what the hell? I said, you know what? I'm stopping this conversation here. But to me,
that's awful.
All the children of the world are my children.
Yeah.
So wow. I don't want any child to... I thought to myself, how can someone actually verbalize that?
I've heard it a couple of times, and it's awful. I don't want to romanticize it, but I really do see these children, both like Israeli and Palestinian children. And when I see children in conflict zones in general, I cannot separate them from my own child. It's actually the reason why I really avoid seeing and reading and hearing anything that has to do with children to protect myself, because I can't handle it. But the things that I see, they're just, I cannot separate it. And I
must admit, I agree with you, because when I look at what's happening to the, because I've got a son, when I look at what's happening to the young boys in Palestine, I think that could have been my son.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be happening to any little boy to have his legs shot off or to be arrested. Because he's a little boy throwing stones. Yeah. So to me, that when I heard this, and when I spoke to the person that connected us afterwards, and I said, you know, I don't want to see this person again, she said to me, but I said, no. To me, it's a moral compass line that is just not negotiable. It's not negotiable. My son, your daughter is my daughter. It's as simple as that. I want dignity and protection and safety for all the children of the world. So to me, I mean, I this is something that will stay with me forever, that comment. And it's a person that is part of my life, but it's something that will change. It's something that I can't unsee or unhear.
It's a horrible, anyway, let's get horrible back. Thing to
it's,
say.
It's a horrible really, thing.
It's I'm
trying to work out what was going on in the brain that person actually said this.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now you've got all these 100 stories.
Yeah. And so now that I live in Denmark, I've been asked a couple of times, and I have thought about it before, about publishing these stories in like a book. They're published on a website, most of the stories, not all of them.
Yes, I did. I did pick them up. I looked at your website and I did read a few of them.
But I've always wanted to have it published. And then I met someone a year ago who again brought this subject up. She herself works in different things also that touches upon women and gender. And she told me, well, why don't you reach out to Danish publishing companies here? I'm sure one of them would pick it up. And so I wrote to one place and met them and got a respectful denial. And then I said, no, okay, I won't take no for... And then I just wrote to, I think, 10, 15 different places. And eventually I ended up working with a very good... not one of the most popular ones or the most famous, but a Danish publishing company that said we would really like to publish these stories, but also to turn this into a book where you introduce some of the these stories.
The women.
Yeah, not all of them, because hundreds of stories you
no,
can.
No, you.
And you also write about, you know, you give some of your personal perspectives. And this was their idea, and it was actually very nice to now be able to write a book where I can maybe get some form of closure with this project. Not closure as it's the end, because I really do want to continue with it, but to get some kind of concluding some of the themes that I've seen, also some of the thoughts that I've had while interviewing, because I've had a lot of thoughts and a lot of my own preconceived
ideas or
biases have been crushed or have been changed. And I have my own story. I have my own background. I have my own traumas, generational traumas that I also had with me in interviewing that I didn't bring up always, or I didn't share them because it was the women's stories. But sometimes I would sit in interview and reflect on, okay, what, how do I feel right now? And how does this link to my dad's family and what has happened there? And I want to share this. I think there's a lot of material here that maybe others can see themselves in. And obviously I want to contribute to giving nuance to this, to Israel and Palestine, and to start a discussion maybe also about how we cover conflict zones, or how we cover areas like this, how we dehumanize people there by just talking about numbers and people as if they are...
And ideologies, yeah. Just an ideology and not the... Yes.
I think that we could do a lot
Can I ask you, were there a lot of similarities in the way they experienced conflict between Israeli women and Palestinian women?
So I want to say, and this is very important, that the project itself is not... I interview women from both sides, or Israeli Jewish and Palestinian women, not in order to show that, oh, look, women in each place are living the same lives, they have the same experiences. Very far from that. If you are an Israeli Jewish woman living in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem, I'm not saying that you have it easier or harder, but it's a very different experience than being a Palestinian woman living under occupation
in
the West Bank and living under a blockade in Gaza. It's not the same. The point of this was to just elevate women's voices, make it a woman's or a gender's, elevate women's voices and to show nuance. But obviously,
and to show contradiction,
to allow for the human experience, basically. And now I forgot what I wanted to say. What was the question? So I had a blackout.
That's okay. I'll take you to another point. This is the one reason in Cyprus we have not. There has been no healing. And one of the reasons there has been no healing is there's been no space for telling stories, for making safe spaces to tell stories. And I think even if it's one-on-one like you do, it's a way of processing. Someone's listened to me. Someone's honored me by just listening to me and keeping silent and making a space so that I can put what I felt and what I'm feeling out there. And I think that, I mean, I asked for similarities and I don't know where that came from, but maybe it's my, but I think just the mere fact of giving women a space to tell their stories, whether privately or publicly, like you want to do, I think it is of paramount importance if we want any type of healing within this tumultuous world we are living in, because I think there's a lot of intergenerational trauma. There's no space for you to listen to me. So I've got all this trauma in me and it's poison within me. So I think we have grossly underestimated the value of just someone listening to my story.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to. I will say also, sometimes there were things that I myself didn't like to hear. Obviously, if a woman were to say something that was an incitement to hate or to kill, I would stop the interview. I've never heard anything close to that from any of the women interviewed, but there were obviously some things that were uncomfortable for me to hear from women, both Israeli Jewish women and Palestinian women. But I think just being listened to is, yeah, it's very, very powerful. It's a, it's a form of, you validate me and my experience. And
yes,
I can also speak, you even though me. I'm not a big politician.
You can see me. Yeah. You can see me. I'm not invisible. I'm not someone that's invisible. You see me by listening to me.
Yeah. But now I remember what you told me. So I will say that an overall topic that I hear in these interviews, even unconsciously or subconsciously from the women, mm-hmm. is the subject of personal security or the lack of it.
The lack of it.
And that is something that I think that I've tried to convey previously when I've met politicians and I've had to convey the essence of these interviews to them. I've spoken about personal security because I don't think that they still today talk about real personal security in a human form. I think it's still the security in terms of military, weapons, walls.
And borders. Borders,
and, underground borders, or these underground, which you had in, I think, on the border with Gaza and Israel, like these underground,
I agree with you. I don't think in the general context when they're discussing war and peace, I don't think this question of how safe am I physically?
Yeah.
I don't think it's understood. And I don't think it's understood how much the threat of me being not safe affects my psyche and whatever, and the trauma it leaves behind, because it's not only rape, and I hate to use not only, it's sexual harassment. I think there were some cases, there were a lot of cases that I heard in Palestine that IDF would go into Palestinian homes and force the woman to take off their clothes. I mean, to me, there is no understanding that it's the threat of what my body means. Mm-hmm. To me, and the threat that people can take away that safety I feel within me with just a look.
Yeah.
Or just a gun pointed at me, like you said earlier, just a gun pointed at me.
Yeah.
So I think it's so underestimated what that does. And because women are not like men in that they are usually a community, mm-hmm. if I have intergenerational trauma, if I have trauma, it affects, it's got a ripple effect.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I actually, when you mentioned this, I've traveled to the West Bank alone also, where I've taken public transport along with Palestinians, not the more privileged roads, settler roads in a car, but I've literally traveled alone, and I've been scared. I've tried to put up a facade, especially in cases where I've then reached a checkpoint, they can see I'm Jewish, they on my or that I have an Israeli ID.
But
I've spoken.
But you're blonde.
But what?
Doesn't it make a difference? But you're blonde. Doesn't the fact that you're blonde make a difference? That you're not, you don't fit into the.
They do, first of all, think before seeing that I speak Hebrew like them, and they think that I'm a European peace activist, which is not a good thing either there. So I right away, when I have the opportunity to speak to them in Hebrew with the most, in a very tough way. And I remember cases where I was surrounded by only male soldiers and feeling, vulnerable. And that is someone who who's not a Palestinian woman. And there you have also the issue of, okay, you have a checkpoint that actually is supposed to protect me, I guess, or to make my security as an Israeli or someone living in Israel, as a Jew living in Israel, better. That's the point of checkpoints. Mm. That's what they talk about. That's the reason why Israel has checkpoints in the West Bank, to make me feel safer. It doesn't make me. I tried to really be like tough as a defense mechanism. I really did not like these experiences. I tried to avoid them. And that is, as someone, again, who doesn't have to visit the West Bank. I could have stayed in Israel and not ever have gone there.
For you, it was a choice to go through the checkpoint. Yeah, that's what I'm... For the Palestinians, it's possibly an everyday occurrence or a weekly occurrence.
Yeah.
And it's something, if they want to leave or go to the hospital or go to work, it's something they do have to do every day. And they also know that every day they might not succeed.
Yeah, it's not a free thing like we do it here. If I need to go to a doctor or the hospital, worst case, there's a lot of traffic. But,
Or even in Cyprus, the worst case scenario, there's traffic at the checkpoint, but you will still get through.
Yeah.
It won't be a case of, well, who are you and what do you want? It will just be a case of, sorry for the delay.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I think people who are quick to judge, let's say, people like me, you have a lot of criticism within the Jewish community. A lot of it is pointed towards someone like me, a self-hating Jew or whatever, someone who's betraying. I think it would be an interesting experience for them, and that to go and try that themselves, and then to make their own conclusions before they judge what I say.
Sarah, we're coming to the end of this really interesting conversation. I could carry on forever.
Me too.
firstly, when can we expect the book? When do you think the book might become a reality?
So I signed the author's agreement in December of 24.
Yes.
And I'm not going to let this drag on for too long. I wanted to come out already. I'm going to try and finish the first draft by October 1st. And then I don't know. I've never written a book like this before, so I don't know how long it takes after that. But I hope for it to be ready and published as soon as possible.
Okay. And you have to let me know so we can go and buy it.
Thank you.
Okay. But I want to close this interview. I want your final thoughts on something that you picked up in these conversations that you had with the Israeli and the Palestinian woman. I like the fact that you talked about the contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this question of personal security cannot be discussed enough, because unless you're a woman and you've found yourself in a vulnerable situation, and I mean, I live in a peaceful area. I went to a peace demonstration outside the presidential palace, and suddenly I got pulled into, I'm also 65 years old, so it's age. I got pulled into a group of about 12 neo-Nazis.
Wow.
These boys, men dressed in black with their veins popping out. For that, fortunately, one of them was humane and pulled me out about 5 seconds later. But for those 5 seconds, I thought, I have never been that scared in my life, and I don't scare. I mean, it's the one time. So unless you've experienced that fear, because if I was a man, I wouldn't have felt the same way. It was my vulnerability as a woman and my age. So what else did you pick up that stood out? I'm sure a lot of things stood out.
Mm.
But is there anything else that you...
Wow, a lot of things. I have to pick one thing. I think so. I will maybe mention the women in Gaza. I don't know what they would... I mean, I do know what some of them would say because I'm in touch with them, but I don't know if the interviews would be the same today with what is going on. But I was very surprised by a lot of what was said by these women. It broke a lot of my own biases and my own preconceived notions. They were very, not all of them, but a lot of them were very fearless. Didn't need to be anonymous, although there's a price to pay in Gaza if you speak to the enemy, or, you know, that is something that people need to understand when they say, why can't people demonstrate against Hamas, change the government, or it's not that easy. Yeah, there was a lot of curiosity from them, from the women in Gaza, to know about the other side, even if they might have a lot of even hate or anger towards Israelis and the Israeli government. There's a curiosity and empathy I even met. That is something that for me was, wow, like, okay, this needs to go out there because a lot of people need to hear this.
Now, that is surprising. I have to say, I interviewed a lovely Israeli woman. That's the latest podcast I did. And she is involved in this. She's another peacenik. Okay. And she put forward the proposal that the concept of, we need to be projecting and working towards political parenting. And political parenting has got to do not with being a mother or a father.
Is that Hamutal Gouri?
Yes.
I saw that she was one of you. Okay. Yeah.
And she said, you know what, and this concept of, we've got to all be nurturers of the next generation, regardless of whether they're Israeli, Jewish, Ukrainian, Russian, Yemeni, or Sudanese. We've got to be curious about the other side, and we've also got to be we've got to want their good, because this is not about the one side being okay. It's about both sides being okay. It's about everyone being okay. But Hamutal is absolutely extraordinarily inspiring.
She is. No, she's also someone I've talked to and connected with, especially at the very beginning of Politico's Personal. She's also one of the, you know, the ones to hear and to listen to in this field.
Okay, I think we could carry on, but I think we can do it for another time. And what I would like to ask you before we close is that if you have anyone that you feel would be a good guest, because I'm always looking for inspiring women. Yeah. I'm always looking to educate myself or to give them a space to speak. So just pass the message on, and we're looking forward to the publication of your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Oh, it's very inspiring. As I said, we would both carry on for another hour, but we've got to stop somewhere. So I would like to send a message to the women of Israel and Gaza and say, please stay safe as far as possible. And to us, peace fighting the good fight. Without us, we've got to keep on fighting the good fight, regardless of the way the world looks at us.
True.
And the comments and the attacks we get. So keep your moral compass in the right place is the way I look at it. We can't do otherwise because it's the right thing to do.
Most definitely. I agree.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you,
and have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.